The Pre-Paces podcast is brought to you by two brilliant sponsors. Paces Ahead is a fantastic four-day face-to-face Paces course run in Brentford, London. They bring you a whole host of patients with fascinating stories and reliable signs, and these patients are absolutely delighted to allow you to hone your exam skills prior to exam day. Some of the patients actually are used in the exams themselves, and the next courses are running from the 20th to the 23rd of May, and then I will be helping out on the course running on the 28th to the 31st of May. Please do come and say hello. I'd love to have a chat and hopefully help you on your way to passing your paces. But if you can't make the course for whatever reason, our other sponsor, Pass Test, has got you covered with their market-leading online revision resource. There are tons of videos which help you revise from the comfort of your own home, and most listeners that I've spoken to have said this is equally essential for your paces success. But that's enough for me for now. Let's get into this week's episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. I'm Dr. Sam Williams, and today we're taking a deep dive into palpitations with cardiology reg Alex Carpenter. Now, this is one of those clinical consultations you might think would be relatively straightforward, which means it can also be a potential banana skin if you fail to get the basics right. And Alex and I talk through the typical presentation of these cases, how you can distinguish the various causes in your history, and how you can strategize your investigations of these patients. And there's more love to be shared on the Buy Me A Coffee page this week. The thank yous go to Alison, who got her first time pass working in a busy DGH with minimal paces teaching. Congratulations to Sophia, Liam, and to Herms, who all passed first time, and to Hain, who got it at their second attempt. Massive thanks as well to Reese, an emergency medicine trainee, and to Sophie, both of whom recently passed first time. I'm so thrilled every time I hear of the podcast helping people pass, and I'm so grateful for anyone who donates in supporting the podcast. So a sincere thank you to you all. But right now, let's get into this episode with Dr. Alex Carpenter. Welcome to the Pre-Paces podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sam Williams, and today we are returning to the motherland, the warm motherland of cardiology. And joining us is another fantastic expert guest. He is a senior cardiology trainee in electrophysiology at the Bristol Heart Institute, and I think it is fair to call him senior. He puts the G in ECG. It's the coolest cardiologist we know. It's Dr. Alex Carpenter. So Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Sam, and I appreciate the dad jokes.
Many more to come, I can assure you. So this episode is going to be focusing on something which we see day in, day out as cardiology trainees, and something you must have seen many times in your years, particularly as a subspecialist in EP, Alex, and it's palpitations. So if I could just start off with quite a broad open question is, how often do you see these types of patients, and how common are they in your day-to-day practice?
Well, yes, incredibly common. I mean, most people sort of, when they hear palpitations, they sort of, you know, take a deep sigh and get ready to, you know, fall asleep. But of course, palpitations, while they're incredibly common and often benign, can belie serious underlying disease in a small number of cases.
And that's why this is such an important topic to include in something like PACES, because you're really going to have to try and focus your history taking to tease out those things which are less benign from those things which are. And that's a lot of what we spend our time doing as cardiologists, is trying to reassure people who need reassurance, but also investigating those who need their symptoms looking into. So without further ado, let's get into palpitations. So Alex, if we could just start off, what do we mean and what might our patients mean when they talk about having palpitations?
Well, palpitations can refer to a number of things, but essentially it's an awareness of somebody's heartbeat, not necessarily rapid. Often people will perceive their heartbeat more if it's irregular. I think NICE refer to this abnormally perceived heartbeat may include irregularity, a feeling of the heart racing or pounding. And often people can be referring to something that's only seconds long, And something that I often hear is a feeling of a missed or an extra beat. And that could be a single ectopic. At the other end of the spectrum, people might be spending 3 days in a regular narrow complex tachy and have to sit on the floor, lie down, etc. So it's a huge spectrum of symptoms.
Yeah, exactly. And so as we've already spoken about, you've got a broad range of possible differential diagnoses. And the important thing with this episode is that the listeners are going to have to tailor their approach to the patients in front of them. But we are going to try and cover all possible eventualities. And so I think we're going to start off just by talking about what are the most common causes of palpitations. And then we can reference those as we go through the podcast with the various pertinent positives and negatives for each. So Alex, if we can just talk through a sort of a systematic approach to how you'd approach a patient with palpitations in terms of the possible causes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, again, this is very pertinent to PACES, but also the real life approach is the first thing is the sort of patient demographics. Who do you, when you're looking at the patient at the end of the bed or in the clinic, who are they? Young, old? Do they have known disease? And that's important because if you're talking to an older patient who may have comorbidities, may have ischemic heart disease and scar, and they're telling you that they're getting palpitations, you're thinking differently to if, you know, 20-year-old woman with normal heart, otherwise well, is talking about palpitations. So first thing is the sort of end of bedogram demographics, the things that you can see. And then again, a history, looking at the classic features of a history. So what's the onset? And within that, when did it start? If you're talking to somebody, say, I've had palpitations, you know, since my teens, since my 20s, and I'm now 50, that's more likely to be something benign. Often that's what you hear with things like AVNRTs or AVRTs. It's something which they put up with for a long time. You know, if they're saying, oh, in the last 2 weeks, I've been getting severe palpitations and I've been presyncopal and things, you're probably more worried that there's an aggressive or evolving process. And with the onset, I'll ask them to describe a typical episode. So does it switch on and off like a light switch? That would be more suggestive of something re-entrant. Because reentrant rhythms tend to, you know, you have an ectopic in the wrong place, which creates a substrate for reentry caused by unidirectional block, and that will get a rhythm firing off, going round and round and round a circuit, and that can be quite constant and go on for quite a long time, as opposed to something which is kind of autonomically mediated, like a sinus tachy or a focal atrial tachy. We tend to see those warm up and cool down. So I'll say, is it more like a dimmer switch? Just to stick with my lighting analogy as a, you know, as the electrician of the heart, obviously. So onset, and then again precipitating or alleviating features, really important if you're thinking about AV mediated reentrant rhythms like AVNRT or AVRT. Often they'll be able to abort them with vagal maneuvers. Often people say, I'll lie down or I'll blow into a syringe or have a cold drink. And something that you tend to hear quite a bit with the onset of those sorts of rhythms is often it's when they're bending over. I don't know the mechanism behind that. But onset's obviously very important. Frequency, that's really important. I mean, again, that's more important, not necessarily for diagnosis, but that's quite important for guiding treatment, because a lot of what we're doing with palpitations is, first, we're risk stratifying. Do you have something that might be dangerous? Do you have a ventricular rhythm? Do you have something which might suggest you've got a pathway, an accessory pathway? But then beyond that, a lot of what we're doing is actually symptom guided. So if you've got an AVNRT or an focal atrial tachy or even AF, a lot of the procedures we're doing are symptom guided. So if somebody's having symptoms once a month or less, then actually that really informs how far you're going to go with their treatment. And then I suppose, what do the palpitations feel like? Are they regular or irregular? Often patients with AF, they were not necessarily bothered by the regularity, but the palpitations, but often just the irregular nature. And the feeling of flipping from sinus to AF, that's something you hear a lot. They say, oh, suddenly I feel I'm out of rhythm, I'm jumping around. And ironically, a lot of those patients, if they develop into persistent, they often aren't bothered by the symptoms so much. But the irregularity, people hate that feeling of, you know, the classic ectopic or short coupled interval followed by a long compensatory pause and then a big contraction. People find that really unpleasant. They say, oh, it's jumping around. And often that's what people report with AF. And then finally, the sort of, I mentioned the red flag symptoms. So when you're taking the history, there's a set of things that I ask everybody, have you ever blacked out? Because that's implying that you've got something that's so fast it's impairing your cardiac output, or you've got something structurally wrong with your heart. So syncope is a red flag. Any features of heart failure, that's a red flag as well. And then family history of any sort of electrical problem, because that's making you think, or heart failure problem, that's making you think about cardiomyopathies or inherited cardiomyopathies, but then also sudden death. And I don't say sudden cardiac death, I just say sudden death or unexplained death at a young age, because we know that a lot of death, which has previously been called, you know, traumatic or sudden or even drownings, you know, they can unfortunately be a cardiac arrest.
Yeah, so definitely the red flags are something to nail into your history taking for palpitations, because missing something like that, such as syncope or a family history of a collapse at a young age or a cardiac death at a young age, this is the type of stuff the examiners are going to be looking at you to probe in your history. And so, Alex, you've mentioned a few of the possible differential diagnoses as well. I wonder if we can just talk through them sort of systematically in terms of how you approach them. And we talked about sort of the typical nature of how they might present. So one of the things you mentioned was ectopic beats. And so they may be atrial or ventricular in nature, but they're often described, as you mentioned, about with regard to skipped beats is how they're often described. And I guess the other thing which is pertinent, which I think you mentioned about, is whether or not it's a tachycardia or a bradycardia. But in my experience, bradycardias often don't produce so much in the way of palpitations, because the patient is maybe less aware of a bradycardia than they are of a tachycardia.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's quite uncommon for people to present with palpitations with a bradycardia. Often they'll be a bit breathless pre-syncopal, or obviously syncopal often in the case of high-grade AV block. But I think we see a lot of palpitations in clinic. It's probably at least 50% of what we see, to be honest. And GPs manage a huge amount in primary care. And obviously, it's very common on the acute medical take. And arguably, it's something which can be risk stratified and potentially discharged or, you know, prevented from actually coming into hospital. And there are all sorts of good risk scores out there. And for syncope as well, there are good risk scores, San Francisco syncope score, etc. And the vast majority of palpitations, you work them up normally with an echo and some sort of rhythm monitoring. And they're both of those are normal. And what you're really hoping to get is symptom rhythm correlation. So I felt awful and my rhythm was this. Sinus rhythm with some ectopics, or I had some, you know, there was some abnormality on the tape, but I didn't feel it. So the vast majority end up being usually atrial ectopics. And having atrial or ventricular ectopy is in no way a sign of an unhealthy heart. And actually, it's quite healthy, particularly if you're young and fit, to have quite a degree of heart rate variability and also to be able to handle ectopy.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about our systematic history taking. We're going to be asking about the onset and importantly, the frequency of symptoms as well, which we'll come onto when we come onto the investigations. We're talking about duration and describing the typical episode that they might report. And then exacerbating factors and triggers. And we'll come onto a bit more on that in the social history as well. And those all important red flags as well. So then moving into the extended history, we've already mentioned a couple of those things, which you'll ask about in particularly the family history, asking about sudden cardiac death in a young age. But also, Alex, you mentioned about a background of cardiac disease, particularly ischemic disease or known heart failure or any other reasons which might leave them vulnerable to a more dangerous arrhythmia or ventricular arrhythmia. So, Alex, I wonder if I can ask you about the other extended parts of the history, which is going to include our drug history and our social history for our patients. So what are the important things that our listeners need to be asking about and probing about in their history for the patient in front of them?
Absolutely. So drugs are really important. I mean, there's plenty of arrhythmic conditions which can be related to drugs. You know, do they have something which could be prolonged in their QT? So commonly, you know, psychiatric medications, macrolide antibiotics. We think that a lot of patients with congenital long QT, we think that a lot of patients with drug-induced QT actually have congenital long QT, but they're able to compensate. They have kind of redundancy in their cardiac channels. We call it kind of repolarization reserve. But when they take a drug which blocks it, you know, they see their GP, they're given erythromycin. Okay, that knocks out some of them. And then for whatever reason, you know, they're admitted to hospital and started on something else, which is QT prolonging drugs. Suddenly their QT shoots out. So drugs are really important. Again, recreational drugs are really important. Things that are vagalytics, yeah, amphetamines, cocaine, really important. I mean, quite commonly people are on huge amounts of energy drinks, you know, something that you hear quite a bit, you know, downing cans and cans of, you know, Monster Energy or whatever, and you know, getting some palpitations. So caffeine, And contrary to popular belief, caffeine doesn't necessarily make palpitations that much worse. In an AF, it doesn't necessarily affect your rate control too much, but huge doses will. And not only caffeine, but also big meals late at night. We know that in younger people, that can be a real vagal stimulant, and big meals late at night, particularly with alcohol, can be a trigger, particularly for sort of vagal-induced AF in young people. So there's other parts of the social history. Occupation, I mean, the big one is driving history. Obviously, there are various causes of palpitations and diseases which can affect driving, and syncope overlays with that. And that's often the bad news that you're having to deliver to people in clinic. Sorry, you've had a loss of consciousness with no clear program. Sorry, that's 6 months. Or you've had an arrhythmia, which is caused incapacity. That's a six-month driving ban.
Yeah. One of the most brutal parts of running any sort of cardiology clinic is having a syncopal patient where, you know, yeah, it's an unprovoked syncope or a syncope without a clear cause. Yep, you're looking immediately at a six-month driving restriction.
Yeah, exactly. And even worse if they're a group 2 driver, an HGV driver, that can be, you know, really, really unfortunate.
Which by and large, these PACES patients often are.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And then other things, I mean, from a PACES point of view, you're going to be asking about other less common but important causes of palpitations which are related to systemic disease. So, you know, an important one not to miss, particularly with AF, but any palpitations is if they're hyper or hypothyroid, actually. So things like weight loss, you know, temperature regulation, so heat intolerance, energy levels, tremor, obviously important from a PACES point of view. The other one that we think of occasionally is pheochromocytoma. Are they extremely hypertensive? Do they have a palpable mass? And the classic there is sort of sweating and flushing. And then AF also associated with obstructive sleep apnea makes it worse. So an important part of AF treatment is actually optimizing upstream risk factors such as OSA. So you ask them, you know, do you wake up tired? Does your partner report that you snore? And then weight as well, really important with AF, high BMI. You know, some interesting work coming out of Adelaide in the last 10 years showing that decent 10% weight loss is as good as an AF ablation in curing AF. So actually a really positive message there that if you can lose a bit of weight, you might be able to get rid of your AF.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely of critical importance to be asking in a broader PACES sense. We're not just blinkered cardiologists, but looking at the whole patient, thinking about the weird and wonderful things which could also be contributing to our patient's palpitations as well. And so, Alex, you mentioned a little bit earlier about examination and how it may not add too much in our PACES examination, but the listeners will be expected to perform some sort of examination. And so even if it's not maybe directly related to clinical practice, what sort of things would you advise for our listeners to perform during their examination of the patient with palpitations, just to go through the motions to the examiner?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I still think it's really important because there are important things there that you don't want to miss. So I think it's really important. Feel the hands, feel the pulse. Does it feel regular? Are they in AF? And what's the character of the pulse? Again, people with severe valvular heart disease are much more prone to heart rhythm problems, so feeling for collapsing or slow rising pulse. Looking at somebody's JVP can be really useful. Again, often patients with decompensated heart failure, they're much more prone to ventricular arrhythmia. It's the most common cause of death in heart failure patients. So examination of the JVP. Examining the face, really important as well. Simple things like, do they have a Marfanoid appearance associated with other cardiovascular comorbidities, valvular issues, as well as an association with HCM? And you know, other things, look at their tongue. Do they have a big tongue? It could be relevant if you're thinking about cardiomyopathies. And then, of course, auscultation of the chest, really important. And again, that's helping you risk stratify a patient with palpitations. Do they have a murmur? Again, you know, we talk about HCM, don't we? If it's has an obstructive component, then they often have that dynamic systolic murmur. And you can ask the patient to Valsalva breath hold to try and emphasize that. And then more broadly, is there any sort of stigmata of anticoagulation in a PACES setting? You know, are there a patient with AF or atrial flutter who's anticoagulated? Do they have something straightforward like the scar of a pacemaker or an ICD? Again, remember these days we've been planting a lot of subcutaneous ICDs. Often the scar is lateral and underneath the armpit, so it's sort of lateral to the nipple, right round on the left-hand side, for a modern SICD, a leadless ICD? Do they have other scars? Do they have a sternotomy scar? You know, if you've had work done in your left atrium before, or you've had your mitral valve replaced, you're much more likely to get things in your left atrium, so focal left atrial tachys or left atrial flutters. If you're a patient with congenital heart disease or corrected congenital heart disease, you're much more likely to get all sorts of arrhythmias.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the other thing just to think about as well from a broad-based PACES perspective is that if they're presenting with symptoms suggestive of those more general medical conditions such as thyrotoxicosis or pheochromocytoma, to be seen to accurately examine that system, whether or not you're performing a focused thyroid examination, examining the eyes, or palpating the abdomen for a mass. Important just to remember, you're not maybe expecting to feel a mass, but you're signposting to the examiner that you know what to do in patients presenting with symptoms suggestive of that condition.
Absolutely. I mean, it shows you're thinking about it, doesn't it? And that you're trying to exclude some of those red flags.
Absolutely. And so next, after you've performed your systematic history and your examination, you'll be expected to talk to the patient and to the examiner about the possible differential diagnosis. And so at this point, we'll end up running through each of our differential diagnoses in turn, and we may well discuss a bit more about their typical presentation, and then we'll cover the broad brushstrokes of the investigations and management.
Just to slightly rewind, a couple of things that I should have said again, signs of heart failure, really important. Signs of heart failure, really important, because the signs and symptoms can be fairly nebulous. If someone's been building up fluid for quite a while, so always listen to the lung bases, sit them forward, listen to the lung bases, look for peripheral edema, and those other things that you're going through the motions, looking for a goiter, doing a thyroid-focused examination, really important, and that could also include looking for eye signs as well if you really want to impress.
Yeah, absolutely. So then moving on to our differential diagnosis for our patient. We may end up covering the same ground that we've covered earlier in the chat, but we will cover each of those in turn. So, Alex, what would you expect someone presenting with ectopic beats? How would you expect them to present? And then how would you approach the investigations and management of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So just simple ectopic beats. They could be atrial or ventricular. Often people report a missed or an extra beat or skipping a beat. It's not sustained, doesn't last more than a few seconds or a few minutes, may not be associated with anything in particular. Again, the association with exercise is an important thing that I haven't mentioned yet, but if palpitations or syncope, pre-syncope for that matter, coming on consistently with exercise or with recovery from exercise, that's another red flag. You're suggesting there might be something more serious there, more serious arrhythmic condition. Commonly, we think of CPVT as being the sort of classic, but several of the sudden death syndromes can be associated with exertion for a number of reasons.
Yeah, and just for the non-cardiologist, that's a catecholaminergic polymorphic VT.
Exactly. can you tell me what the pathognomonic ECG findings of that are?
No.
It's bidirectional ventricular tachycardia on exercise. So they have VT, which is sort of fluctuating in polarity. So again, yeah, so simple ectopics tend to come and go, not necessarily associated with anything. Often people describe that they're a bit anxious, or it can be worse when they're more stressed, and it's very rare for them to be associated with loss of consciousness. But what people do notice is that when they notice them, often they can get worse. So they can say, I feel a few extra missed beats, and then I notice it, and then my heart starts pounding. And I think, I always tell them that's a kind of vicious circle. They notice it, they have a fight or flight response, they have an adrenaline release. Nothing they're choosing to consciously do, but that adrenaline release, it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It makes the heart pump faster, makes it pump harder, and often a bit of reassurance from someone like you or I can actually break that cycle. So they just think, actually, no, it's fine. My heart's healthy, and, you know, I can ignore it. Hopefully they'll have a normal ECG, normal examination, no family history of any serious illness or sudden death. Usually, unless it was really, really clear, normally we'd have an echo to ensure they have a structurally normal heart. And that's important for two reasons. One is to make sure that palpitations aren't a sign of cardiomyopathy. And the second is that if you have a high burden of ectopics, particularly ventricular ectopics, can actually cause a cardiomyopathy. So we normally say less than 10% burden of ventricular ectopics is fine. More than 20% is likely can cause LV impairment, and 10 to 20 is a bit of a grey zone, but above 20, be looking at trying to suppress that either with beta blockers in the first instance or possibly ablation if we think it's a sort of unifocal area which we could target. And beta blockers tend to be the mainstay of treatment if they're really troublesome. At most of the time, reassurance seems to do the trick.
Yeah, fantastic. So then moving on from ectopic beats, we're going to move on to a big umbrella term of tachycardias. And we're going to, if we focus first on the sort of supraventricular tachycardia, so if we focus on the AVN and AVRT reentry tachycardias, you talked a bit about the typical nature of how these present earlier, Alex, but if you could just re-emphasize that for us.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, EP... It sounds all very complicated, but actually it's just the same thing happening in different places. You know, so tachycardia, basically most of it is re-entry. Macro re-entry is, you know, when you can kind of sit, you know, it's somewhere, an appreciable circuit. In micro re-entry is when it's happening around a few cells, and it, you know, we talk about AF. So the macro re-entrant tachycardia is, again, just pick your spot in the heart, and if you can get an electrical circuit to race around somewhere, then you can get a tachycardia. So if it's racing around the AV node round and round, we call that an AV nodal reentrant tachycardia. And about a third of us are born with a bit of extra wiring in the AV node instead of one pathway, the fast pathway, or a second wire, the slow pathway. So typical AVLRT will go down the slow and up the fast pathway, round and round and round. It's a tiny little area, so it's often very, very quick. The tachycardia in these will be extremely rapid, you know, upwards of 200 beats per minute. It's narrow complex, usually, because it's within the node, so you've got normal Hispokinji conduction. You can get aberrancy, and often the right bundle will be the first one to go at that sort of rate because it's so quick. You'll hit the refractory period of the right bundle, and it just can't keep up. That can obviously give you a broad complex tachycardia as a differential diagnosis. If you've got an accessory pathway, you're born with an accessory pathway, you can have two types of palpitations. You can have one which... more common one where it will go down the node and up the accessory pathway. So that's an atrioventricular reentrant tachycardia, so AVRT. And the most common one going down the node, that's the most common one. That's what we call orthodromic because it's going forward through the node, so it's narrow. If it's going the other way around, which is less common, down the pathway and up the node, going round and round, that would be broad complex, and we tend to call that antidromic. That's less common because people often have pathways that just conduct backwards but not forwards. And of course, that's important because if your pathway conducts forwards, it's more likely to be dangerous. Because what we worry about in patients with pathways is the ability. So Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is obviously an accessory pathway plus symptoms. We worry that if they were to have an uncontrolled atrial tachycardia, such as AF, flutter, or any uncontrolled atrial tachycardia, they would have those fast impulses conducted straight into the ventricle without any filtering. And the node is very good at, the AV node is very good at what it does, specialized conducting tissue, which has the ability to decrement. So the faster and the harder you push it, the more it pushes back and says, oh, hang on a minute, that's a bit quick, puts the brakes on. And we use that in the EP lab to do all sorts of testing. But pathways aren't AV nodal tissue usually. They're usually an embryological remnant of a bit of atrial tissue, and they don't have that decremental property. So one of the common things we do in the EP lab is we'll test how rapidly someone's accessory pathway will conduct. And that's why if you're treating a patient with a narrow complex tachycardia, after you terminate the tachycardia, it's really important to get a 12-lead ECG of their normal non-tachycardia heart rhythm to make sure they're not pre-excited. There's no evidence of a pathway there. So that's AVNRT and AVRT. Obviously, those circuits involve the AV node. So if you block the AV node, for example, with adenosine, they can't carry on. So they're adenosine sensitive. That's often something you'll hear in the history. I've been to A&E, they gave me adenosine. Now those tracings invariably aren't available to you. Oh yeah, no, they recorded it at X hospital. And, you know, they said they'd send it, but they haven't. But if it's adenosine sensitive, that's really a, you know, good pointer that it's probably an AVNRT or an AVRT. Other places that you can have reentrant rhythms around your tricuspid valve and annulus. So typical atrial flutter, it's common, born with it, more common as you get older. Often there's that, you know, classic onset and offset, but again, it can persist a long time. People can be in it persistently for weeks, if not months. Other places you can have reentrant tachycardias in your ventricle, VT. Now again, that usually people notice that more than atrial tachycardias, because if you've got a reentrant rhythm in your ventricles, it's likely to impair your cardiac output, so you're likely to feel some degree of presyncope or syncope. particularly in healthy hearts, you can get quite rapid VTs. And sort of focusing, just to wrap up the other causes of narrow complex tachycardias, obviously AF, sort of micro reentrant or, you know, ectopy, which originates in the pulmonary veins in the left atrium. More likely to have it if you have those upstream risk factors, hypertension, high BMI, those sort of metabolic things. Obstructive sleep apnea is known to be associated. If it's very quick, it can be difficult to differentiate on an ECG because it's difficult to spot the irregularity. The important thing with AF and flutter is the anticoagulation, of course. That's what kills patients with AF and flutter. Other than that, the jury's still out on rhythm control versus rate control. You know, I probably can't say that as an EP trainee, but having said that, you can make people feel a lot better. And atrial flutter is very relatively straightforward to treat typical atrial flutter. By typical, we mean that it involves the cavotricuspid isthmus on the right-hand side around the tricuspid valve, and typical would tend to be counterclockwise. It's just easy. You put a catheter up and burn a line down across their CTI line, you know, when it goes well. Atypical might be on the left, might be somewhere else on the right, can be much more difficult to treat. And again, AF, paroxysmal AF might be 80-90% successful ablation-wise, but probably better the quicker you get it. And it can be good for quality of life. Persistent AF is a completely different beast and can be quite difficult to treat. And then other things that we see, focal atrial tachycardias, very common in patients with structural heart disease or previous work, congenital heart disease or previous ablations. And they can be quite difficult to treat, can often be very rapid. They can kind of have that dimmer switch effect, so they warm up and cool down. Often associated with stress, and they can be really incessant as well. They can go on for a long time. I think I've covered most of them there.
Yeah, I think you have. I think you've covered pretty much everything that any PACES candidate would want to encounter. I think probably the key thing for the listeners is, at least in my experience, I haven't heard many stories of PACES cases coming with an ECG. My feeling is you probably wouldn't be expected to interpret an ECG, but what is more likely is you speak to a patient, you take your history, and then the examiner gives you a bit of information, such as the ECG shows, or an ECG during an episode of symptoms shows atrial fibrillation. And previous ECG done a week prior showed normal sinus rhythm. How would you proceed, or something of that nature? But Alex, we've talked through the differential diagnoses in a lot of detail. So we're going to go back to our broad brushstrokes approach, and we're going to talk about the general principles of investigating management. And I want to draw the listeners' attention to one particular phrase, which I think is so critically important that it needs some sort of klaxon to it, which I may well put it in post-production. But that is rhythm symptom correlation. So Alex, can you just if you can talk to us about rhythm symptom correlation, and then maybe give us an insight into the various forms of ambulatory cardiac monitoring devices which are available to us to try and obtain rhythm symptom correlation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is so important, because again, the symptoms of the symptom of palpitations can be quite nebulous. So it's really important to try and record that patient's ECG while they're experiencing the symptom they're talking about. Because if they experience the symptoms while they're experiencing a normal heart rhythm, you can be reassured that actually it may be anxiety related. It may be that they've got, you know, there's an overlay of anxiety, and at times they're experiencing palpitations, but at times it's more of a perception of palpitations. Again, you can correlate what they're saying to a run of ectopy, you know, single ectopics, or a very short run of ectopics. That's very reassuring. But that can be a number of things. That can be somebody seeing you in clinic saying, when I'm in AF, I feel really unwell, like I do now. Look at their 12 lead there and then. We know that single ECGs are very bad at spotting paroxysmal arrhythmia, sort of, you know, 3-7% detecting AF. And even Holter 24-hour tapes are quite poor at detecting things like AF. I mean, having said that, when people talk about daily symptoms, so palpitations caused by ectopy, for example, 24-hour tapes can be really helpful if they're getting them every day. And I'll ask them, you know, just take a typical day, do what you normally do to provoke your symptoms. If you normally get them, you know, going for a run, go for a run. You often start with a 24-hour Holter monitor. You know, these days a lot of people have smartwatches, Apple watches, and that sort of thing. And, you know, there are various brands of ambulatory devices that people either often have, or if we've done a bit of investigation and we're reassured, but we say, oh, you know, maybe you could pick one of these, you know, I think they used to be called Alive Core cardio devices, pick one of them up, and if you get a typical episode, record it and send it into our arrhythmia nurses. They filter through, you know, and often when we're, you know, when I'm looking through a case, I'll be looking through 20, 30, 40 of these, you know, emails in with strips, and they can be really helpful because they often show you what the patient's experiencing, and that's the total burden of the patient's sort of symptoms. And sometimes there'll be one or two true paroxysmal arrhythmias in there, lots and lots of sinus ectopy in there. So that helps you firstly get a diagnosis, but also set the expectations to the patient that, okay, maybe you are having AF, but the vast majority of your symptoms are actually a normal heart rhythm. And sinus tachycardia is incredibly uncommon. And again, there's a bit of a debate as to what extent that's pathological. When people talk about inappropriate sinus tachycardia, POTS, again, that's quite a contentious area. But it's not uncommon that we do an EP study and it's actually a sinus tachycardia. When we give the patient isoprenaline, you know, that synthetic adrenaline, that totally recreates their symptoms, but they are in a sinus tachycardia. They might be young. They might be having incredibly rapid sinus tachycardia. Again, for patients that we're a bit more concerned about, so patients who have had a syncope, for example, patients who are at risk of sudden cardiac death, so say a first-degree relative or of a patient who's had a cardiac arrest or something else that puts them at risk but doesn't have a clear ICD indication. So say, for example, somebody's got a spontaneous type 1 Brugada pattern on their ECG or a long QT, but they're asymptomatic, you'd consider more continuous monitoring. So implantable loop recorders, something that we use very commonly, particularly in syncope. They've got a really good evidence base. And this is something that's implanted just under the skin. It takes about 10 minutes to do with a bit of local anesthetic. They last for up to 3 years. Again, on an examination of a patient, you'd see a scar somewhere on their left precordium, and it normally angled down towards the cardiac apex. And they give you a single lead ECG. They can be very helpful. They can either be activated by the patient or their event triggered by various algorithms, and they last for up to 3 years before the battery runs out. And then the final sort of symptom rhythm correlation that we can often do is via device. So patients that already have devices, and different devices are better or worse at recording events, and often ICDs will be slightly more sophisticated, but they can be very useful at recording arrhythmia. What to do with it can be a difficult question, and device-selected AF is a contentious issue. But they do give you another source of information.
Yeah, fantastic. And I guess the thing for our listeners to take away with this will be, in your history, as we've discussed, you'll be talking about the frequency of symptoms that the patient's reporting. And this is really important because it's going to guide how long you might consider your period of ambulatory monitoring. If the patient's reporting daily symptoms, you've got a reasonably good chance of picking up rhythm symptom correlation with a 24-hour tape. If it's happening weekly, obviously a 24-hour tape is going to be far less helpful, and you might consider a 72-hour or a 7-day tape. So this is all going to be important for your discussion with the examiner and justifying your strategy of investigation for these patients.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes you'll chat to somebody and say, oh, I get palpitations all the time. You look down at their 12 and they've got 2 or 3 ectopics on that, and you think, okay, this is going to be somebody with a lot of ectopics. You know, I guess that could be a potential PACES thing. You look and there's a few ectopics on there.
Yeah, fantastic. And Alex, we've talked a lot about ECG so far, but we're going to go back to our basic lab tests for these patients as well. Whilst they're not a huge mainstay of investigation and management, they're still important. We don't neglect those, as PACES is a requirement of PACES is to be completist in our assessment. So how much value can we get from lab tests in this sort of situation, and what should the listeners be reporting that they should be asking for in terms of lab tests to their examiner?
Absolutely, yeah, it is important. And I mean, I think even the most sort of routine blood workup is important. You know, this sort of standard full blood count's important. If somebody has a significant anemia, they could obviously become tachycardic with that, just a sinus tachycardia. Or if there's evidence of infection, again, that's just a cause of physiological tachycardia. Electrolyte disturbance is really important in the context of arrhythmia. The sort of electrolytes that we tend to think most about, potassium, low or high, is pro-arrhythmic. Magnesium can be, and particularly we know that actually slightly higher magnesium, slightly higher potassium can be used to sort of stabilize the myocardium a bit. And of course, you know, magnesium is one of the treatments of Torsades, polymorphic VT. And then important, again, if people are on antiarrhythmics, you know, digoxin can be quite toxic in the context of a low potassium. And then other blood tests, thyroid function, obviously really important. Again, thinking about endocrine things, just looking at the endocrine type blood tests, let's say, is there sodium null? Is there evidence of some sort of pituitary issue or, you know, something else which is going to push you towards further investigation there? And then you've got the cardiac blood test. So if they've got troponin, is that high? So suggesting that might be an ACS or a myocarditis, which can be associated with all sorts of arrhythmia, ventricular arrhythmia. BNP these days, we're thinking about a lot, you know, as a screening test for heart failure. And again, patients with heart failure are much more at risk of ventricular arrhythmia.
Absolutely fantastic. And if we move on to the imaging, we've already mentioned that an echocardiogram is the sort of bread and butter that we would ask for in the workup of these patients. And as you've already said, Alex, it's often just helpful to help rule out any structural heart disease, but also rule in if you have found something abnormal, a murmur on examination or something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an echo is a really good, easy tool to, as you say, to exclude structural heart disease. I mean, sometimes in EP, we kind of, even with the normal echo, we're a bit suspicious. You know, we know that there are these cardiomyopathy syndromes, particularly inherited cardiomyopathies, that might develop as the phenotype develops as you get older. So, you know, if we think somebody's got, you know, right-sided ECG, a T-wave inversion in the right pericardial leads and features of VT or syncope, we think, do they have arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy? Even a normal echo, we might think, let's get a cardiac MRI to look at their right ventricle in more detail. So while an echo is reassuring, it's not a cast iron guarantee that they've got a structurally normal heart, but it does provide reassurance. Again, there are certain antiarrhythmic medications like flecainide you wouldn't want to use in a patient with structural heart disease or coronary disease, such as flecainide. And an echo is useful in other ways too. If somebody's got a big left atrium, you know they're less likely to benefit from rhythm control therapy in AF. Cardiac MRI can be really helpful, as it shows you if somebody has a normal heart structure, looks at their function in good detail, and also, you know, we inject gadolinium and we can see whether they have scar and whether that might be a focus for arrhythmia such as VT.
Yeah, brilliant. And I think that's probably all the candidates would be expected to discuss in terms of imaging. But the critical point of the station will be whether the examiner gives you a diagnosis or whether or not you're just left with the open-ended patient with palpitations. So, Alex, if we can move on to the, we'll talk about a bit about the management. I think we've talked a bit about that with regard to each of the respective differential diagnoses, but I wonder if maybe we can talk a little bit about, in fact, let's move on to answering the examiner question. So if the examiner poses a question to one of our listeners and says something similar to, what would you be looking for on a 12-lead ECG of this patient? Let's presume that they haven't been given a working diagnosis or the results of an ECG that's been performed. What should the listeners report that they would be looking for on a 12-lead ECG?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think one question to ask as a candidate is, I may ask, did the patient have typical symptoms at the time of recording of the ECG? That shows that you are thinking about, you know, if the ECG shows AF, the patient was asymptomatic, well, that's not the problem. And I think the ECG, you're getting two things from the ECG. One is you're getting information about that patient's heart. Is it, you know, structurally and electrically normal at baseline? And the second thing you can see is there any obvious arrhythmia actually detectable on the ECG? It seems unlikely that they're going to have symptoms at the time of the ECG recording. So it may be normal even in the presence of a paroxysmal arrhythmia. The kind of key things to look for: major abnormality, so evidence of ischemic or structural heart disease. So, you know, are all their baseline intervals normal? If we think about structural heart disease, you know, are their ST segments normal? Is there evidence of axis deviation, both in the limb leads, but also in the chest leads? Look at where the transition is. It should be somewhere in the middle, you know, V2 to V4. If it isn't, that's abnormal. Do they have evidence of LVH? That can suggest HCM. And HCM is the most common cause of sudden cardiac death globally. You often get widespread T-wave inversion or ST elevation. And then other evidence of structural heart disease, ST or T-wave changes. Probably the sort of top four things that I would look for on an ECG are just literally just the top four causes of sudden arrhythmic death. HCM, as we've said, ST elevation or T-wave inversion, widespread. Number two, Brugada syndrome. So type 1 Brugada syndrome pattern. And you could, you know, if the examiner asked you about other types of Brugada patterns, you could say there's type 2 or type 3, which can become a type 1 at different times. For example, during a fever, That's an important thing to note, or during electrolyte abnormalities. And often you can, a patient who has a normal ECG might have a drug-induced provoked type 1 Brugada pattern. If they're given a provocation drug such as Ajvalide or Flecainide, that's how we test for that in these patients. So that's number two. Number three, long QT syndrome. Is the QTC normal? It might be reported for you. If not, a good rule of thumb is, does the QT interval look less than the R to R interval? That's like almost like the cardiothoracic ratio of the ECG. If it's less than half, it's probably normal, corrected. If it's more than half, you need to sit down and work it out. And the correct place to work out the QT interval is if you take the maximum slope of the downward deflection of the T wave where it intersects with the isoelectric point. So long QT. And then number four is ARVC, or we now call it arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy. It tends to affect the right ventricle, but can affect the left. That's a very subtle ECG finding. We call an epsilon wave, which is like a little bit of fractionation, like a little bit of kind of zigzaggy stuff at the end of the QRS, often a Leeds V1 and V2. And that's just telling you there's a little bit of scar where conduction's really slow in the right ventricle. You might also have right axis deviation, a bit of T wave inversion in the V1, V2, V3, V4, suggesting something's wrong with the right heart. So those are the big ones not to miss. And then we mentioned again with CPVT. I'm so glad I managed to find something that I knew that you didn't know. CPVT, again, that would be elicited on a treadmill test.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can be sure that bit's getting cut, Alex. So yeah, don't worry about it. So Alex, very finally, this is something that's way advanced for our listeners, but we will just talk through the broad brushstrokes of management of our differential diagnoses. I think ectopics, you already talked through where we can suppress it using beta blockers or possibly an ablation. So we'll move on to the tachycardia. So if you could talk us through the AVNRTs and the AVRTs for us.
Yep, great. Again, with ventricular ectopics, sort of more than 20%, particularly in LV function, think about referring because they can benefit from ablation. And we're talking about the SVTs. If they're not controlled with tablets, then refer for an ablation because often these can be over 95% curative. That could be quite a straightforward procedure, has a massive impact on quality of life. If there's any suggestion of an accessory pathway, again, referring for an EP study and ablation can help us risk stratify. Again, if they've got an accessory pathway, potentially fixable with a relatively simple procedure, and it can be prevent them from having a life-threatening arrhythmia. AF and flutter, really focus on the anticoagulation. That's where the morbidity is with stroke, and then treat symptoms after that. Flutter, quite easy to treat with ablation. Again, you can see the theme here. AF, on the other hand, very difficult to treat with ablation. Paroxysmal, better. But if somebody's asymptomatic, then there might be a case to manage them just with rate control, anticoagulation. And then VT, again, speak to your friendly cardiologist and get advice for that. And again, palpitations, just remember, they're not boring. They're actually really interesting.
Yep. Your VT patient is, you're going to want them to at least be an inpatient if there's any signs of compromise or syncope or what have you.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's quite uncommon that we'd ever manage a VT patient in anything other than as an inpatient setting. Again, you can get normal heart VTs, right ventricular outflow tract VTs, which are sort of relatively benign. But even in those patients, we still get a cardiac MRI to make sure they don't have ARVC. So okay, your VT patients, again, you want to be managing in a sort of cardiology setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, listeners, I think that's just about all the time we've got for this week's show. That only leaves us to pay a huge debt of thanks to senior cardiology trainee with a subspecialty in electrophysiology, Dr. Alex Carpenter. Alex, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
You're welcome, Sam. Thanks very much.
And listeners, that's the end of another show. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to the show and leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're always keen to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can do that on our Twitter. It's at Prepaces Podcast or via the website. But if you really want to go above and beyond and support the show, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/Prepaces Podcast. But for now, we're just about out of time. I've been Dr. Sam Williams. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Prepaces Podcast.